Let me begin with the third story from Helm. In the synagogues of Europe, especially East Europe, there we have the synagogue building. Next to it would be another building, which would be the synagogue school. And the student body in the synagogue school was growing. It was getting more and more crowded. And so the elders of the synagogue in Helm decided to expand the building. And Rabbi hired some local workers to do the job. And while the workers were working, he decided to go out there and see how they were doing. There was one worker doing something strange. He would pull out a nail from his back and look at it and hammer it in. He pulls another nail, looks at it, and then throws it away. So some nails he hammered in, some nails he threw away. Rabbi asked him, "Why are you throwing these good nails away?" And the man answered, "When I pulled the nail out of the bag, I noticed sometimes they put their head at the wrong end. I can't hammer in that way." But the rabbi says, "No, no, you don't understand. These are for the other side of the building." That one has a double whammy. Okay, with the marriage ceremony over and done with, we now have the section on the second coming in chapter 19, verses 11 through 18. And what he describes is what he described back in chapter 1 with the glorified Son of Man and the various different symbols he used to symbolize the issue of being a king, but especially the role of a king, which is a judge. And so now what he describes in verses 11 through 13, he's coming as a judge of chapter 1. And he wars against all the armies of all the nations. He's called the faithful and true. He's not wearing a Stephanos crown like the rider upon the first horse, the crown of a conqueror. He's wearing the diadem crown, which is the crown of royalty. And he mentions in these verses that as they come, his clothing has been stained with blood. And people are now looking at the Old Testament first, assumes that's his own blood. His garments are stained with his own blood. But as we saw in Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, his garments are stained with the blood of the enemy, not his own blood. So that's the blood here, based upon Isaiah 63, would be the blood of the enemy. In verse 14, he comes back with armies. The word army is plural. So at least two armies he comes back with. And from Matthew 16, verse 27, we know it comes back with the angelic army. But secondly, he also comes back with the church saints, the army of the church saints. And that's in 1 Thess 3:13, chapter 4, verse 14, the book of Jude. I forgot to put the chapter in, but the verses are 14 and 15. However, he will fight all alone, as we saw in Isaiah 63. So verse 15 and 16 is now described specifically as the king, the Lord of Lords, the King of Kings. And now he's finally coming to function in his third office. During his first coming, he functioned as a prophet. He now functions as our priest and the future will finally function as a king, the king of Israel and the king of the world. And because of the massive slaughter he will perform on the enemies, in chapter 19, verses 17 and 18, as a result in verse 21, the birds will devour the flesh. A similar in Ezekiel chapter 39, verses 17 to 20. But the Ezekiel passage at the end of verse 39 connects to Israel's final restoration. So he's dealing with the great supper of God resulting from Armageddon. Ezekiel 39, verses 21 to 29. For some background material, you have Isaiah 34, verses 1 through 7. God has indignation against all the nations, which we already saw. The conversions on earth and the shakings in the heavens. And the place identified as Edom, which is southern Jordan, and specifically Bozra, in verses 6 and 7, which today is Petra. Isaiah 63 also dealt with this background already. And so verse 19, you have a simply summary statement of the whole campaign of Armageddon. The beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gather together to make war against the Messiah, against Messiah's army. It simply summarizes the many passages we talked about earlier. And now we have the results of the second coming, where it deals specifically with the members of the counterfeit Trinity. And so, first of all, the counterfeit Son and the counterfeit Spirit, the Antichrist, we know he'll be the first casualty of the second coming, especially based upon 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. Also, similar points are made in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 13. Now, the Isaiah 14, verses 3 through 11 passage points out that he will be killed and his soul ends up going into hell. And all the kings that got into hell before him rise up in astonishment that he suffered the same demise as they did. But he makes a statement that his body will never see burial. And that's explained in verses 16 to 21. It describes the armies fleeing, trampling the body. It also says the body will not see burial. And now we see why. Now keep in mind, he's been playing the role of the counterfeit son, a multiplicity of names, a counterfeit virgin birth, a counterfeit God-man concept, a counterfeit in many areas. But he's going to play the counterfeit role one step beyond what he would have wanted to. Because he is killed at the second coming in the first passage. But now he'll be resurrected from the dead, which is why he will not see burial. And he's the first one cast into the lake of fire. And the lake of fire all to himself for the first 1,000 years of its habitation. So he's the first one resurrected into an immortal state in an unglorified state to spend eternity in the lake of fire. You have the false prophet. He's also cast alive into the lake of fire, so that both of them have the lake of fire all to themselves for the first 1,000 years of its habitation. And then as for the Gentiles of the armies and so on, verse 21, the rest were killed by the Messiah and the birds have their fill of their flesh. Now it deals with the counterfeit father, and Satan will now be confined into the abyss as part of the humbling of Satan. God will give the authority of only a common angel to bind the anointed cherub, to bind them in the abyss. And how long has this will be his fifth abode, which will last for 1,000 years. And the abyss, as I mentioned previously, is a temporary place of confinement for all angels or demons. And the purpose, notice, is no longer be able to deceive the nations. And so for the whole 1,000-year kingdom, there's no satanic temptation because it's the abyss. There's no demonic temptation because they're confined either in southern Jordan or southern Iraq. But then comes the note, because the abyss, notice, is always a temporary place of confinement. After 1,000 years, he will be released. And he goes on to describe the Messianic kingdom in only three verses. Notice he spends a lot of time with the tribulation, spends almost no time with the Messianic kingdom. And that's for a very simple reason. Because the tribulation is many different events coming sequentially, one after the other. And so we have tribulation to solve the problem of what happens when. The book of Revelation primarily focuses on the tribulation and brings many other passages into the picture from the Hebrew Bible, so we can tell in what order these prophetic passages will be fulfilled. But the Messianic kingdom is a kingdom, is basically a lifestyle, a way of life and so on. And everything we need to know, it's not an issue of chronology, but lifestyle. So everything we need to know about the Messianic kingdom is already in the Hebrew Bible, and there's no problem with chronology or sequence. But it will answer a couple of issues that were not answered by the Hebrew Bible. And the chart you should be looking at is chart number 9. Chart number 9. And in verse 4, notice he mentions three different groups of saints that will co-reign with the Messiah. First of all, the church saints, because it is those who received the judgment, and that was the judgment of the seat of the Messiah. Then you have two categories of tribulation saints. First of all, those of the first half that were beheaded for the testimony of Yeshua and for the word of God. And then you have the saints of the second half of the tribulation. These are those who did not worship the Antichrist or his image, did not take the mark of the beast. So these three groups of saints will be given positions of authority in the Messianic kingdom. Now, the term first resurrection is a term that refers to the resurrection of believers only. Resurrection of believers only into an immortal state. And the first resurrection undergoes stages. Let me see if I have it here. Okay, I will. And he points out that the resurrection of the tribulation saints will complete the program of the first resurrection. And the first resurrection is separated from the second resurrection by 1,000 years. The second resurrection will comprise only those who are unbelievers. So the first resurrection concerns only believers, and that's why it says they are blessed and they are holy. Now, there'll be 5 specific stages, and the first stage is already complete, and that is the resurrection of the Messiah in 1 Corinthians 15:23, and he's referred to as the first fruits of the first resurrection, because he's the first one resurrected into an immortal and glorified state. The second stage will be the church saints at the rapture in 1 Thess chapter 4, verses 13 through 18. The third stage will be the two witnesses in the middle of the tribulation in chapter 11, verses 3 through 13. The fourth stage will be the Old Testament saints in Isaiah 26, verse 19. And Daniel 12:2. And finally, the tribulation saints in Revelation 20, verse 4, and that's why their resurrection completes the first resurrection. Now, the issue of the future Messianic kingdom, which involves Israel's final restoration, this is a major division in the church. Now, we have church writings from the 2nd, 3rd, into the 4th century, and what those writings show is that the church was almost exclusively pre-millennial. What that means is the Messiah will come before the millennium, and he will set up the Messianic kingdom, the millennium. They were not clear about Israel's final restoration, but they were very clear that there would be a kingdom following the second coming. That began to change because of two individuals in church history. First of all, a man named Origen, who introduced the allegorical method of interpretation. And he applied the allegorical method to the Bible as a whole, including the historical section. What was important for him is not the obvious meaning of the text, but a deeper hidden meaning. And then came Augustine, or sometimes Augustine, who took those principles and applied them to Bible prophecy and applied them to Israel. He came up with a new kingdom concept that's become dominant in the church to this day called amillennialism, that the millennium, that there is no literal millennium after the second coming. So they believe in the second coming. The second coming will mark the end of the world. There'll be no kingdom thereafter. So the kingdom should be interpreted allegorically, and the 1,000 years is not the literal 1,000 years. It's simply a symbolic number between the first and second coming. So what they were teaching is, we are now in the Messianic kingdom. We are already now in the millennium. Now, coming from my Jewish perspective, I would say if this is the millennium, we must all be living in the slum section of the millennium. It's not as nice as the Bible describes it. And they would accuse us of basing a whole doctrine of the millennium upon one chapter of scripture, which is Revelation 20. And Revelation is a highly symbolic book, so it's foolish to base a major doctrine like the kingdom on one chapter of the Bible in a highly symbolic book. As we already noticed, every symbol in Revelation is explained anyway, but the figures like 1,000 years, 3.5 years, 42 months, and all that is never interpreted symbolically. If it's a symbol, Revelation fails to tell us what that symbol is. But that's not the basis for belief in the Messianic Kingdom. For example, the Messianic Kingdom was the major belief of Orthodox Judaism as it still is. And Revelation is not part of the Jewish Bible, so where did the Jews get their views from? So years are never viewed as being symbolic, but literal. There's no need to spiritualize them away. And what is true is that only Revelation 20 uses the figure 1,000 years, but it mentions it 6 different times. If repetition tries to say anything, it tries to make a specific point. But the true basis for belief in the Messianic Kingdom is two things. Number one, the unfulfilled promises of the Jewish covenants. And God made 4 eternal, unconditional covenants with the Jewish people. And most of these promises have remained so far unfulfilled. And therefore, to fulfill those unfulfilled promises of the Jewish covenants requires a Messianic Kingdom. And secondly, you have the unfulfilled prophecies of the Jewish prophets. The prophets took the promises of the covenants and gave us further elaboration. And there has to be a fulfillment of these unfulfilled prophecies at some point. That's the true basis for the Messianic Kingdom. The unfulfilled promises of the Jewish covenants and the unfulfilled prophecies of the Jewish prophets. Now, so this is the true basis for belief in the Messianic Kingdom. Now again, if all we have is the Hebrew Bible, we could assume that once the kingdom is established, it will go on forever. Now, Revelation 20, we learn it won't last forever. It lasts for 1,000 years, and then will come forever. So you have the Abrahamic covenant, promised the eternal seed developing into a nation that will possess all of the promised land, and at this day, Jews had occupied all of the promised land. And the promised land was not promised only to the descendants of the patriarchs. To all three men, Abraham, then Isaac, and Jacob, he says, to you and to your seed, I will give this land. And when they died, what did they own? A burial cave they had to pay good money for, a plot of land near Shechem to pay good money for, and some wells which they had to fight for. That was the extent of their real estate holdings. You have the land covenant in Deuteronomy chapters 29 and 30, and he points out there'll be a worldwide dispersion followed by a worldwide regathering, and no one debates that the worldwide scattering has already been fulfilled, and fulfilled very literally. But Moses did not change his audience when he spoke about a worldwide regathering. And he points out in verses 1 of 2 of chapter 30, no matter where the Jews live, they'll all come to faith. When all come to faith, we'll have the final restoration, the final regathering of the Jewish people into the land. You have the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7, 1 Chronicles 17, that promises 4 eternal things, an eternal dynasty, an eternal throne, an eternal kingdom, and an eternal descendant, the seed. And the eternality of the throne, dynasty, and kingdom is guaranteed because the seed of David culminates in one who is himself eternal, the Messianic God-man. Well, the Messiah has come, has not yet reigned over a kingdom from the throne of David in Jerusalem. That requires a future restoration. Yet the new covenant in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34, there promises of going to be a certain generation of Jews when the whole nation will come to faith. And that has not yet happened either. So for these covenants to be fulfilled, it requires a final future restoration. Now here are some unfulfilled kingdom prophecies. For example, the Messianic kingdom will have a government. And it'll be a very functional government. There won't be any red tape. It's a Jewish government, so it'll maybe have blue and white tape, but not red tape. The Messiah himself will be the one that will be the ruler of the entire world. There'll be two branches of government, a Gentile branch and a Jewish branch. And the Gentile branch will have the authority of the church and tribulation saints that will co-rule with the Messiah over the Gentiles. These are all in glorified bodies. Then you'll have kings in their natural bodies and then the Gentile nations. The Jewish branch of government will have the resurrected David co-ruling with the Messiah in the Messianic kingdom. Under him will be the 12 apostles who promised they will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Under them will be a category called princes. Only one is actually named, and that is Zerubbabel in Haggai 2, verses 20 to 23. And they will be judging the ruling of Israel, and Israel will have individual Gentiles as their servants. So as far as the kingship of Yeshua, these are the various verses that will speak of him as the world ruler. He'll have worldwide authority. The branches we've just spoke about. What's the wondering about the role of David? You'll find these four passages, Jeremiah 30, verse 9. Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 23 and 24, and chapter 37, verse 24 and 25. Hosea chapter 3, verse 5. Many people interpret this as not to be David, but David's greatest son. But when it talks about David's greatest son, he uses different terms, like the seed of David, the branch of David, the root of Jesse, and things of that. He just simply says, David. There's no reason not to take it as it reads. And then the 12 apostles promised, the princes, judges, and counselors. This will be over the Gentile nations. In these verses, God promised that this will be the head and no longer the tail. And this will the kingdom, Israel will be totally regenerated to each individual. They'll be regathered, and all Jews will be living in the land. And now for the first time in their history, will possess all of the promised land. The throne of David will be reestablished. They'll be reunited as a nation, never to be subdivided, as happened when Jeremiah died. They'll be the head over the Gentiles, and they'll serve as God's witnesses. Here you have this is from the map book, but here you have the Malil Israel, as described in Ezekiel chapters 47 and 48. And what he points out, this is the whole promised land right here. All of this is Lebanon, the part of the area the Jews never had, but will have in the kingdom. And the Jews will be resettled by tribal division. So the first seven tribes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, will be north to south. Then you have a new mountain in the land, and then you have the last five tribes right here. And here's the detail of the holy mountain. It'll be a new mountain in the land. It'll rise to become the highest mountain in the world. Measure, it'll be roughly 50 miles square. And it'll be divided into three subdivisions. So northern division, which is going to be right here, is going to go 20 miles by 50 miles. And then right in the middle will be the Millennial Temple. That's where it will stand. The building itself, the compound itself, I should say, will be about a mile square. It won't even fit the present-day temple compound. The central section, which is right here, also 20 by 50, will be for the tribe of Levi. And then the southern section, will be for the King Millennial Jerusalem, which is right here, 10 miles square, and both sides of it will be ground for growing food. And a river will flow from the temple compound, flowing east, and begin to go south through Levi's territory into Jerusalem, then split in two, with half the river going into the Mediterranean and half of the river going to the Dead Sea. And that will change the nature of the Dead Sea. It'll become a major fishing industry in the upper and central level. But if you want to do your Dead Sea float, you can still do that, but it says only the south end will be given over to salt. Here's another close-up of that territory. Now you see these benches here, but rooms. The priests that will function with the temple will be the sons of Zadok. Zadok was the loyal priest to the house of David and therefore given this privilege. And so the priests were descendants of Zadok will be living in this area. Other Levites will be living over here. And Levites will be the caretakers of the temple, so they'll go in some kind of a ritual where for a period of time, certain Levites have to go and do the caretaking, so they will live in these chambers, travel in the morning, come back here at night until their period of time is over, then go back to the main living area, and other Levites will take over their occupation. There's the Millennial River and the passages. As far as the Gentiles of the kingdom, they'll be subject to Messiah's reign. They'll be subjects, they were servants of Israel. But an obligation they've had before, they'll be obligated to send a delegation to observe the Feast of Tabernacles in Zechariah 14, verses 16 to 19. In the Mosaic law, the observance of tabernacles was mandatory for Jews only, but now becomes mandatory for Gentiles as well. Any nation that will fail to send a delegation will suffer a drought. For the whole kingdom, the whole earth is blossoming like a rose. There'll be two desolate spots in the kingdom, which is where the demons will live. Babylon, which is southern Iraq, and Edom, southern Jordan. And these two will be places of confinement for all the demons. Now the aftermath. Same chart. After 1,000 years, Satan will be released in verse 7. And in verse 8, he again does the work he's learned to do well, the work of deception. In the last century of the millennium, many have been born, many are still in a status of unbelief. And from these many unbelievers, he gathers one last army for one last revolt against God's authority. Now, as far as life and death in the kingdom, the key passage is Isaiah chapter 65, verse 20, which teaches that those born in the kingdom will have till their 100 year to believe. If they believe by the age of 100, they will then live throughout the kingdom and never die. They'll be glorified at the end of the kingdom. But those who choose not to believe will die at the age of 100. So death in the kingdom will be reduced, but not eliminated. It's for unbelievers only, even for them at the age of 100. Last century of the millennium, many have been born, many are still under the age of 100. So this last revolt will be strictly a youth movement, because everybody in this revolt will be under the age of 100. And that's youthfulness in the kingdom. And from all over the world, they will come. And the invasion is described in verse 9 that comes specifically against the people of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. When they finally entered the land, God will simply dispense with them with fire from heaven. And at that point, Satan enters the sixth and final abode, the lake of fire. He'll join the other two members of the Count of the Trinity, and there they will be forever and ever. That will lead to what the final judgment called the Great White Throne Judgment in chapter 20, verses 11 through 15. The judge will be the Messiah. He's not actually named in the Revelation text, but in John 5:22, Jesus said, "All judgment has been given to him to exercise." So based upon John 5:22, he is the judge on the great white throne. As far as the old order, we have known since Genesis chapters 1 and 2 will now pass away. And in verse 12, the judgment is applied to all unbelievers of all time. From Genesis to Revelation, all unbelievers of all time will stand before this final judgment. The purpose is not to determine who is saved, who isn't saved. Once a person dies, it's known whether by heaven whether he was a believer or not. So not determine who believes, who doesn't believe, but rather the purpose is to determine degree of punishment. All unbelievers end up in lake of fire. Not all unbelievers will suffer the same degree of punishment. For example, in Matthew 11, verse 20 to 22, we describes the people of certain wicked Gentile cities that are against the Jewish cities that saw most of his miracles. It'll be more tolerable for those Gentile cities like Sodom and Gomorrah, and less tolerable for the cities of Chorazin, for Capernaum, Bethsaida, because they saw the majority of his miracles. Also, some are beaten with few stripes, some are beaten with many stripes in Luke chapter 12, and Jesus himself made a distinction between lesser and greater sin. So these are the elements that will determine degree of punishment. So the appearance of the Great White Throne Judgment is due to their failure to accept the Messiah, but the degree of punishment will be based upon their works. Now how they will be judged is based upon the specific books. And he will distinguish between three books: the Book of Life, the Lamb's Book of Life, and those other books. The Book of Life contains the name of everyone who is ever born. That's Psalm 139, verse 16. And those who become believers, their name is retained in the Book of Life in Revelation chapter 3, verse 5. But those who die unsaved, their names are blotted out of the Book of Life in Psalm 69, verse 28. Yes, it is possible to be blotted out of the Book of Life. That is not meaning a loss of salvation. It means dying rather than being saved to begin with. And so when they open the Book of Life and they don't find their name in it, so it shows the name has been blotted out, and therefore they're worthy to stand at this judgment. Now, the other books contains the history of the deeds of responses, and degree will be based upon these books on two principles. Number one, the degree of the sinfulness, and secondly, what did they know about the truth and chose not to believe? Those would be the two key principles: degree of sinfulness, and what did they know and chose not to believe. And the third book is called the Lamb's Book of Life. It's not the same as the Book of Life. The Lamb's Book of Life contains the names of all who are saved in Revelation 13:8 and verse 17:8, and these names were put into the book from the foundation of the world, because God knew to his own foreknowledge and everything else who would believe. So the foundation of the world, those people who would believe, the names were written in the Lamb's Book of Life. It's called the Book of the Righteous Ones in Psalm 69, verse 28. And it's not possible to blot out of the Lamb's Book of Life. So in time of a judgment, the names Lamb's Book of Life and the Book of Life will be the same, except the Book of Life has many blanks. Lamb's Book of Life will have no blanks. And then we have the second resurrection, which is resurrection of unbelievers only in verse 13. This has two stages. The first stage was the resurrection of the Antichrist, before the millennium and now all unbelievers after the millennium. And they will suffer the second death, which is the death of the lake of fire. And we often talk about the salvation. We should believe to spend eternity up in heaven and spend eternity in hell. Neither statement is biblically valid. It's basically true, but not completely. Nobody will spend eternity in hell. Hell is temporary for the soul only. And at this second resurrection, the souls are brought out of hell, reunited with the resurrected body, and where they will spend the eternity will not be hell, but a lake of fire, which is worse as torment for both the soul and the body. That's why the residents of the eternal order in the lake of fire will be all of the lost, all fallen angels, and so on. Now, the Old Testament period, there's a place which I think I explained previously, but Hebrew called Sheol, Greek as Hades. And from Adam to Messiah's death, all went to the same place. All went to Sheol, but it had two compartments in Luke 16, verses 19 through 31. The unrighteous side had the section called hell, and the righteous side had the section called Abraham's bosom. The believers went to Abraham's bosom, which is where paradise was located at that point of time. And so Jesus said to the person that was co-crucified with him, who became a believer, he says, "Today you will be with me," where? In paradise. And paradise was located in Abraham's bosom. But that changed with the work of the Messiah. The Messiah died and entered into Sheol, into Abraham's bosom. And by his death, the sins of the Old Testament saints were now removed, because he now paid the price. The basis of judgment of sinners was paid by his own blood. And so he sent it to heaven. He took the souls of the Old Testament saints with him into heaven, in Ephesians 4, verses 8 through 10. So at present time, things have changed for the believer, but not for the unbeliever. The unbeliever still goes to hell. Believers now go directly to heaven. 2 Corinthians 5:8, Philippians 1:23. So to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So this is the second resurrection. Hades is now also emptied. And the final abode is the lake of fire. And now we come to the eternal order, and from Revelation 21, verse 1 through chapter 22, verse 5. You're still on the same chart here. In the verses 1 through 8, you have the passing of the old order and the creation of the new order. God creates brand new heavens, a first heaven, a second heaven. He also creates a new earth. And as he begins to describe the new earth, he will tell us of a lot of omissions. The first omission is no oceans. The sea is no more. And this removes all of the effects of Satan's fall, because if you look at Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 11 through 19, when this earth was created, there were no oceans and no seas. There was a beautiful mineral garden covered by 10 different kinds of precious stones and metals that exuded light. And Satan had authority over the earth and walked up and down amidst the stones of fire. But when he fell, the earth was judged and covered by the salt waters of verse 2. And as a result, that was the result of Satan's fall. And then when he began to fashion the earth anew to make it habitable for a new race of beings, humanity, some of the effects of Satan's fall were removed, dry land appears, but most of this earth is still covered by salt water. And only with the creation of the new earth there's a final removal of all of the effects of Satan's fall. But the New Jerusalem will not need to be created. It already exists up in the third heaven. It will now come down upon this new earth. and be adorned with the beauty of a bride adorned for a husband. Now, most of the material about the eternal order is in these last two chapters of Revelation, but we have three other little small glimpses of eternity. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 26, Paul describes the city up in heaven as one that is free. The one on earth was under Roman bondage, but the one in heaven is a free city. In Hebrews 11, verse 9 and 10, this is the city that Abraham sought. What replacement theology does with these two verses is say that shows God was not promising Abraham literal real estate. He was promising him heaven. And so they replace the land promise with this promise. But this is not a replacement issue. It's a plus issue. It's obvious that he did promise Abraham the land, which Abraham will enjoy for a whole 1,000 years in the Messianic kingdom. This is an addition to that promise, not a replacement of that promise. And finally, it describes the eternal abode of the redeemed in verses 22 through 24 of Hebrews 12, and he points out the various residents. I wonder if I list this. No. And what he mentions is that will be the home of God the Father, God the Son. He does not mention the Spirit, but will be mentioned in the Revelation passage. He also mentions all of the holy angels that did not fall with Satan. He mentions then two different groups of saints, church saints and Old Testament saints. Church saints, the church of the firstborn, and the Old Testament saints, those souls that were the righteous and justified, but now being cleansed, meaning that they did become believers before Christ died, but the sins were not taken away at that point of time, that way till Christ would die. So you have two different groups mentioned in the holy city in heaven. There'll be two different groups of saints, church saints and Old Testament saints. You have the first declaration of the one sitting on the throne, verses 3 and 4. The habitation of God will now be with men. And he lists all of the curses that fell because of Adam's fall in Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 to 19. And now we see the removal of all the effects of the curse. There'll be no more tears, no death, no mourning, no crying, no pain. Then in verses 5 to 8, there's a second declaration of the one on the throne. And that focuses on the works of God. So you have a declaration of the creation of the eternal order in verse 5. In verse 6, the provision of the fountains of the waters of life, the provision of salvation. In verse 7, the inheritance of the believer, which will be the eternal order, and then the inheritance of the unbeliever. In verse 8, the second death in the lake of fire. He then gives as much detail as God chose us to give us on the place where we shall be living forever. From chapter 21, verse 9, to chapter 22, verse 5, you have the eternal New Jerusalem. So verses 9 and 10, you have the establishment of the city. And John is again told to come up hither, as he was told once before in chapter 4, verse 1. In chapter 4, verse 1, to receive more revelation about the future and now to be told more about the eternal New Jerusalem. And he's promised to be shown more about the bride of the Messiah. And namely, he'll be shown in verse 10, the abode of the bride, where the saints of the church will live forever, the New Jerusalem. He then gives a rather detailed description, not a great detail, but a somewhat detail, of what the city is like. From 21:11 through 22:5, he mentions 11 things, but the first and 11 is dealing with the same thing. Now, keep in mind, he's using things which are literal, but also serve as symbols. Just like we take literally of the bread and the cup, but the bread symbolizes the body of the Messiah, the cup, the blood of the Messiah, but we still do this literally. So these are literal things, but they have a symbolic meaning. The glory of the city that provides all the light will be the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory. And this will be the final abode of the Shekinah glory, which will be in the New Jerusalem. Yet the city wall in verses 12 and 13 symbolizes protection. It will have 12 gates. Each gate is under the authority of an angel. Each gate is named after one of the 12 tribes of Israel. So those Jewish names, the Jewish tribe of Israel, will continue on forever. The foundation of the wall in verse 14 symbolizes permanence, and the number of foundations will be the number 12, named after 12 apostles, so those apostolic names will continue forever. The measurements of the city in verses 15 to 17 symbolize spaciousness. It would be a four-square city like a cube, 1,500 miles in all sides, 1,500 miles wide, long, and high. And the wall around it will be equivalent to our measure of 216 feet high. And here we're going to give you the dominant colors. The wall will be made of jasper. The city will be made of transparent gold. The foundation, we'll talk about the next slide. The gates are all made of one singular pearl. So one giant singular pearl will make up one gate. There'll be 12 such big pearls. I would hate to deal with the oyster it came from, but it's going to be a big thing. And the street will be made of see-through transparent gold. There's the foundation. Notice the dominant color. Jasper is green, sapphire blue, chalcedony greenish, emerald green, sardonyx red and white, sardius fiery red, chrysolite golden yellow, beryl aqua green, topaz greenish yellow, chrysophrasus golden green, jacinth violet, amethyst is purple. But dominant color, notice it's green. The dominant color will be green. So my conclusion is there'll be a very strong Irish influence in this eternal city. Then he mentions some more missions. There'll be no temple there. The sun won't be there. The moon won't be there because all the necessary light we need to live by will be the Shekinah glory light. In verses 25 to 27, the gates will never be closed. And there'll be a total absence of the night, so it'll be just a continuous eternal day. That's the fifth mission. Only the righteous will have entry into the city because the unrighteous are excluded and confined in like a fire. There will also be a river, no oceans, but there will be a river in verse 1 that have the brightness of crystal. And the river will flow throughout the entire street of the city. The word street is singular. That means the river will begin somewhere on top and wind its way to all parts of the cube city until it finally works its way out to one of the city gates. And so it'll be a multi-thousand mile river. There you will see the tree of life that was in the Garden of Eden will now be here. The tree trunk will extend to both sides of the river. It's characterized by productivity. It'll bear fresh fruit every single month. And those dimensions of month, there will be some kind of a dating system. It won't be the same as ours that goes by the interchange of day and night. There's no night anymore. And so on. So we do not know what the system will be, but the mention of month shows there'll be some kind of a dating system. Maybe they'll use the system, if you're a Star Trek fan, star date 1.732, something along that line. Now, here's where lesson some questions leaves for the healing of the nations, the healing of the Gentiles. We already learned from chapter 21, there's no sickness anymore. There's different Greek words for healing. The one that is used here is the source of English word therapeutic. It means health giving. And these leaves on the tree will be therapeutic. They'll be visible symbols, visible leaves that will symbolize God will not allow any illness to come into a new earth as it came into the earth in which we now live. In verse 3 and 4, there'll be a total absence of the curse, the triune God, and all redeemed with the name of Yeshua. And in verse 5, he ends what he began. There should be no light needed, not no night needed, but no light needed. And there's no artificial light needed. All the light we need will come from the Shekinah glory. And now we come to the conclusions of the book. In verse 6 and 7, it has received the authentication of God. And in verses 8 and 9, the authentication of the angel that has been giving this information to John. Concerning the book itself, there's a contrast here with Daniel. When Daniel finished his book in chapter 12, verse 8 and 9, he was told, seal the book, because much of the book could not be understood. There's too many gaps in the information. The historical segments of the book is understandable, but the prophetic things in the book can only be partially understood, so Daniel is told to seal it. But John is told not to seal it, because now those gaps in Daniel are filled in with what we find in Revelation. Now we can have all of the necessary information. As far as the righteous and the unrighteous, the unrighteous are to confirm their unrighteousness by continuing in their unrighteousness. The righteous are to confirm their righteousness by continuing in their righteousness. In verse 12, concerning the purpose of his coming to reward according to each man's works. That's not the salvation issue, it's the punishment issue or reward issue. And concerning the person of the Messiah, he's eternal. Alpha and Omega. Alpha is the first letter of the Greek alphabet, Omega the last letter. Everything else falls in between. So he's the first and the last, he's the eternal one. And verse 14, concerning the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem, these are for those who believe. But turn for a moment to chapter 22, verse 15. Chapter 22, verse 15. I happened to be married to a fanatical cat lover. The time we got married, we always had a multiple cats around. We've had as many as 7 cats at a time. And once she had a kitten that grows up in the house, they never leaves the house. She's afraid they might be eaten up by a coyote. And they became house kittens, so we slept in our bed. And when I was on a trip like I am right now, the cats would always sleep on my side of the bed. When I would come home, I would have to fight them for the right to sleep next to my own wife. And if you visit our house, you'll see all kinds of pictures of kittens and cats, even little statuettes of kittens. I'm sometimes suspicious that when I'm not home, she's actually bowing down and worshiping those images. And so she feels that all cats go to heaven. That's her theological conclusion, and the verse he uses is chapter 22, verse 15. In describing the dogs like a fire, it says, without other dogs. Doesn't say cats, just dogs. And therefore, she concludes that all cats go to heaven. Then you have in verse 16, the first affirmation of Messiah. Messiah sent the angel to John to reveal all these things. And notice here, here's the humanity. He's the root and the offspring of David that focuses on Messiah's humanity. He's also the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory, focusing on his deity. And verse 17 is the invitation to salvation of the Holy Spirit in the church, because the Holy Spirit does the work of conviction, does the work of calling, but the church has to be the one to present the gospel to those who don't believe. And in verses 18 and 19, he warns people against any additions or subtractions. So specifically, it's actually meaning additions and subtractions to the book of Revelation. But because the book of Revelation is the last book written by an apostle before he dies, once the last apostle dies, there's no more scripture to be recorded, so it would apply to the Bible in general. And those who are guilty of additions are all cultic groups like Mormonism, Christian Science, and so on. They have the Bible, but also have another book that's equally holy, even more so, because you cannot understand the Bible except through this additional book. So these are the ones who are guilty of additions to Scripture. And those in verse 19, guilty of those who make subtractions, those are the ones who are liberal and deny many of the fundamentals of the faith, like the virgin birth, like the resurrection, and so on. So both of these, those who add and those who subtract, shows their unbelief, and therefore will not enjoy the kingdom or the New Jerusalem. The second affirmation in verse 20, he testifies the truthfulness of all that John wrote by stating he will be coming soon to fulfill all these prophecies. He's coming quickly. He is imminent. And with this verse 21, with this book, with this statement of grace, the book comes to an end. The grace of the Lord Yeshua be with the saints. Amen. This is not everything we wish to know about how we spend eternity, but he's simply given us a glimpse. And what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 is still true. I had not seen, ear had not heard, nor did it enter the mind of men what God has in store for us. I want to make sure you understand you won't be bored. You won't be simply sitting in the clouds learning how to play the harp. We'll be actively serving the Lord, actively learning and learning more. We'll never become omniscient. We'll spend eternity learning more and more. And that's the way we shall spend eternity. Okay, before I open up for questions for about 15 to 20 minutes, then I'm going to have to get ready to leave and go back to my wife. Make sure she's not worshiping those images of kittens. Here's your last rabbi story for this weekend. Also from hell. The rabbi was reading an article on ice fishing. He'd never seen that before, never heard it before, but he got interested in it. And Poland, where he lived, had lots of lakes with kosher fish, so he decided to try to do some ice fishing. He did not want to go alone, so he took one of his elders with him. They found a sheet of ice, and they began cutting a hole. And suddenly they heard the voice from on high, "There's no fish below the ice." They're startled. And the rabbi asked the elder, "What was that?" And the elder says, "I don't know what that was, but this makes me nervous. Let's just go somewhere else." They go somewhere else on the ice and start cutting a second hole. And again they heard their voice, "I said there was no fish below that ice." And the rabbi asked the elder, "Do you think that's God speaking?" The elder says, "I don't know if it's God, but if it happens again, you're the rabbi, you better ask. But let's go somewhere else. They go to a third part of the ice and start cutting a third hole. And again they heard the voice, "Once again, there's no fish below the ice." Rabbi gets up his courage and says, "Is this God speaking?" "No, this is the ice skating rink manager."